At the watchtower over the main gate, three farmers gulped at the roasted hickory nut drink called coffee, for lack of a more accurate term. Valentine asked them for their best guess about which direction the harpies were last seen flying, and got three slightly different answers. The consensus seemed to be a little north of east. Most of the town still worked to keep the blaze from spreading. The exception was the Helm family. The father retrieved his son's body, while Mrs. Helm sat on the steps of her porch with her arms around her other two children, dully watching the flames consume the great barn. Valentine climbed down from the watchtower. Bourne and the other eight reservists waited by the militia stable tack shed. Recently turned earth next to the little wooden shack exposed two stout cases. Bourne gingerly examined the contents of one of the open cases.
How is it, Tank?
Still usable. We turned it this summer when we blasted the new drainage ditch from town. Quickest way I know of to get rid of tree stumps.
If I promise not to ask where you got it, will you spare us some of that bang?
Valentine knew the dynamite had probably been lifted from a Southern Command supply cave, perhaps with the aid of a small bribe to the resident quartermaster.
If it means paying the harpies back in their own coin, I'll tie up a couple of five-stick bundles and have them fused before you can say nitroglycerin. Part that worries me, though, kid, is you wanting to take off right now. Wandering around in the dark with a hood around, looking for something you aren't sure where it is, well, it's like playing blind man's bluff in a room full of buzzsaws.
Valentine squatted down and looked at the dynamite.
I want to hit them while they think we're still busy with this fire.
Yeah, I buy that. One thing you got going for you, anywhere these things are holed up, it's sure to smell like a well full of dead skunks. They shit as much as pigeons, and you up everything proportional. I know they eat like crazy, and their handlers aren't too particular about what they feed them.
Valentine's entire team volunteered for the duty, but in the end, he took two. He asked two others to borrow horses and ride for the nearest command post. The rest would guard against further attack in case the harpies came back to finish the job. Valentine just prayed the Reaper didn't decide to come back. Valentine took Gil Delvecchio and Steve Oren with him. Steve Oren, a brassy young man who enjoyed hunting, had ventured many times into the borderlands east of Weening in search of game. Oren had the best knowledge of the land and excellent eyes. He'd once explored as far as the St. Francis River, which marked the belt of uninhabited land surrounding the Ozark Free Territory. Gil was a powerfully built farm boy from the Missouri Valley in the Dakotas. He exuded strength and could be relied on to keep his head in a fix. Delvecchio had been one of the two men to climb the silo. His sweaty skin was still stained with soot. The three forced down a quick meal as they loaded up 2 days' supplies in rucksacks. With weapons, ammunition, dynamite, and almost no camp gear, they could move quickly even in rough terrain. Valentine brought his pistol, with 6 bullets left in the magazine, and the best compass and map Bourne could provide. They hiked out the main gate a few minutes after midnight, turning down an offer by the other Helm boy to go along as their guide. Valentine told him he would help his family more by fighting the fire that threatened their house. He mentally added that while the killing machine that took his brother was probably elsewhere by now, perhaps striking again in the confusion of another harpy attack, there were too many other risks in the eastern dark for Valentine to chance losing both of a mother's sons the same night. The Reaper was much on Valentine's mind as the three men moved east. Oren picked the trail. Valentine followed several paces behind, making sure he stayed on course, and Delvecchio walked just behind, rifle ready for instant use. The hood obviously worked with the harpies, but would it decide Cho was a valuable prize to be taken for questioning? Her nondescript uniform differed little from any other impoverished residents, and she carried no weapon. Perhaps she was grabbed as a weak target that could not put up much of a fight to be consumed at a later time. Valentine prayed Cho had lost consciousness from pain and shock. He could not bear the thought of his closest friend being carried east to a dreadful end, screaming out her pain the whole way. By 3 a.m, the men reached the wide St. Francis River. A few ruined buildings that had been reclaimed by the wilderness more or less stood on its hilly banks. Valentine looked into the skull-like emptiness of a brick house, the interior nothing but humps of collapsed roof and saplings, and thought of the world that was. 50 years ago, little cabin cruisers and fishing boats must have floated up and down the river, its banks under control and sandbars dredged. But with man occupied elsewhere, nature had reclaimed her own. At a rest halt, he began to despair of their hunt. The harpies could be anywhere.
Val, there's a light on the river.
The three climbed a little promontory and looked north at the distant speck of light. It was near the western bank of the 100-yard-wide river, but whether it came from boat or shore could not be seen at this distance. Who would be fool enough to burn a light right at the border? A guide for the returning flyers? Valentine was suddenly hopeful. They decided to check it out. Valentine and Orin readied their rifles and picked their way north, keeping under cover. When they got close enough to see that the light in fact came from a boat, they rested for a few minutes before creeping forward again. Orin had the best night vision of the three, and therefore used the binoculars.
It's a small barge and a towboat.
They lay in a little hollow, peeking at the river from behind a fallen tree.
It's like five men visible on the towboat. One's got a gun. No one's on the barge. Its riding light must be practically empty. The light is on the barge, electric, not a lantern.
The towboat was attached to a ruined concrete piling, projecting out of the lake, perhaps the last remnant of a dock. Orin leveled the binoculars at the barge.
They got it anchored at the front and the back. If anyone's in it, they're staying hid.
A gust of wind off the river made the men wrinkle their noses. They exchanged glances.
Oh, shit. I think we found the nest.
They hashed out a plan. Valentine would take a bundle of dynamite and swim to the ship from the north end of the barge. When he set it off, the other two men would start sniping at the tugboat, with hope that it would be lit by the burning barge and use the other bundle of dynamite on it from the shore. Gil said he was sure he could throw the bundle the 30 feet from the shore to the boat. Delvecchio pulled a hand axe from his belt. The weapon was light and handy, more of a fighting tomahawk than a tool.
Thanks. We'll meet back here. If you're being chased, just go west and wait for me.
Hope you don't puke easy if you're gonna get close up to that thing.
Let's not waste any time. I want to get this over before dawn. Maybe that hood sleeps in the barge.
Valentine stole past the lounging figures on the tug. If five men were up and around at this hour, perhaps 10 more might be crammed below. Or were they out, somehow helping the harpies? Once he had the bulk of the barge between him and the towboat, Valentine crawled through vegetation to the water. The dynamite, matches, and his pistol rested on his back in a pack that might keep the water out for a moment or two if he was lucky. Valentine kicked off his shoes and crawled into the cold water. It reminded him of his bath and how Cho had dried him off afterwards. He took the comforting wood handle of the tomahawk in his hand and half floated through the water toward the barge, moving like an alligator with just eyes and nostrils out of the water, the pack making a sea monster hump on his back. He felt as alive and alert as if he had just finished a light breakfast after a long night's sleep, rather than having been awake for 18 hours. It was a good thing he hadn't eaten recently. When he slithered close enough to really smell the barge, a horrible musky odor mixed with a sharper, turpentine-like smell assaulted his nostrils. The hazy moonlight revealed details of the ancient barge, a mass of rust and paint and makeshift welds, with M33 painted on its side in 3-foot-high letters. Valentine shifted the tomahawk to his mouth, holding it between his teeth with straining jaws and breaststroked into the river. He made for the stern anchor line. The gentle current assisted him with its chilly flow. He reached the cable, grateful for its hand-filling thickness. The deck of the barge was as beat up as its sides. It had a single hatch open to the sky. The battery-powered lamp, a conglomeration of what looked like a car battery and a truck headlight, pointed up into the night, but seemed to bathe the whole top of the barge with an intimidating, revealing light. Valentine wished he had told Orin and Delvecchio to start firing when they saw him reach the barge. He could use something to draw the men's attention to shore. Still dangling, he gently placed the hatchet on the deck of the barge. Now or never. He hoisted himself up on deck and crawled for the hatch. Expecting a shout at any second, Valentine peered into the reeking hole. He could make out little in the dark, but there seemed to be floor 6 feet or so down. He rolled over the edge and landed barefoot in sticky filth, axe ready. The hold stank like a slaughterhouse, and he had to fight down his gorge as he stood up in a cramped little area. A gutter ran the length of the deck, filled with excrement. The hollow interior was empty. No. As his eyes adjusted, Valentine realized that a panting shape leaned against one wall. It was a harpy, wrapped up in its own wings, as though in a leathery cocoon. A trickle of blood pooled beneath its rump, wounded, maybe dying. The debris on the floor included a melange of bones. A cluster of human skulls decorated a metal pillar, part of the barge's rusting structure holding up the deck. The heads looked like a yellowish bunch of coconuts. There was a door forward out of the hold. A body lay at the bottom of stairs descending from the door. Pale, naked, and headless. But it was nevertheless familiar. Valentine had found Cho. An awful kind of warmth filled his stomach. He no longer minded the reek. He could make out slit nostrils and a toothy pointed jaw decorated with bristling cat-like whiskers protruding from the tent of folded wings. Wet drool dripped out with its rapid, shallow breathing. Valentine raised the small axe. The thing never knew what happened. Valentine leaped on top of it, bringing the blood and brain-soaked tomahawk down again and again. Flecks of blood splattered his snarling features. A familiar flapping sound came from the hatch, and the light reflected from the deck lamp was obscured by a winged shadow. Valentine crossed the hold to the forward stairs to the door, keeping clear of the hatch. He could sit there, light the dynamite, and blow a few harpies to kingdom come. Shots echoed from outside. Delvecchio and Oren must have panicked at the returning harpies and tried to prevent them from re-entering the barge. Valentine somehow ignored Cho's body, took his pistol, and tossed the backpack onto the stairs. A harpy flopped into the hold, one wing injured.
Welcome home, fucker!
The harpy's scream brought answering shrieks from outside. Valentine knew he was drawing all kinds of ugly from the skies, as well as the tugboat, but he wanted Cho's body to have a lot of company feeding the crayfish and gars. The tugboat crew must have a support weapon mounted on deck. Valentine prayed that Delvecchio and Oren were smart enough to pull out now and head west. Valentine pounded on the roof of the hold.
Dinner! Dinner, come and get it!
The wounded harpy pulled itself toward him, gremlin mouth open in vicious anticipation. Other flappers dropped into the hold. Valentine took 2 steps backwards toward the door and found a bundle of dynamite and tin of matches. Grabbing a bunch of matches, he struck them against the rough side of the stairwell, illuminating the dank little closet space. Valentine lit the fuse, dropped the matches to the floor, and picked up his pistol. He fired a shot into the vague shapes collecting in the hold. He then placed the hissing dynamite on the first stair and pushed at the hatch. Locked. He bashed at the hatch with his shoulder, closing his eyes to the expected oblivion that would blow him into bloody fragments, but the rusted lock gave way. He threw the door open and dashed onto the deck. Then dived for the water on the riverside of the barge. He felt a bullet pluck at him as it passed through his shirt at the armpit. Valentine was underwater when the explosion hit. The boom sounded muted, but its force thumped at him even through the cushioning protection of the river, knocking the breath from his body. The shattered rear half of the barge upended as pieces of its hull splashed into the river all around. The towboat was a mass of flame, the machine gun silent. The harpies, incendiary bombs, must have been on the towboat's deck in readiness for another attack. Valentine got his bearings and submerged again, swimming for shore. No doubt a few very unhappy harpies still circled above. His fingers struck the river bottom. As his brain cleared, he realized that he was unarmed. His pistol was at the bottom of the St. Francis, dropped when the concussion from the explosion racked him, and the tomahawk was also probably landing somewhere in the Mississippi. He gathered himself and ran out of the water and onto the riverbank. Picking up a river-smoothed rock in each hand, Valentine hurried under the protective overhang of the trees. He felt defenseless as a rabbit with raptors circling above, but made it to the little hollow without trouble. What was left of the tugboat was floating downstream in flames. An answering warble came out of the darkness. The pair joined him. Orin returned Valentine's rifle.
Quite a show, Val.
Delvecchio put the other bundle of dynamite back in his pack. Bourne could use it on more tree stumps or trade it for corrugated tin to build a new barn. It felt good for Valentine to have a rifle in his hands instead of rocks.
Orin, you need a break. I'll take point on the way back. You can keep us on course, and Gil, you cover.
The light of the burning towboat faded as it sank behind them, and the three started for home. Not knowing how well the harpies could see, hear, or smell, they stayed under the trees. Nothing dived at them or circled above. Later, they sang softly as they walked through the shadowed woods, like young athletes returning home from a successful match. Beneath the bare-boughed canopy, Valentine felt safe from any of the surviving harpies. But the trees made the Reaper's attack that much easier. It stepped from behind a tree, plucking the gun from Delvecchio's hands and sending it spinning into the night. With its other hand, it picked him up by his backpack, holding the giant young man at arm's length like a filled diaper. Valentine and Orin spun around, flicking the safeties on their rifles. The Reaper put the frantic Delvecchio between them like a shield.
Drop him!
No! Wait! No! Don't let him! Don't shoot!
You might as well shoot, foodlings! You'll all three be dead as soon as I take you!
Oh, God! Let me go! Val! Get it off me! Get it off me!
Valentine thought his heart was going to break out of his chest. It pounded so hard. His tongue felt dry, and his eyes seemed misted over. Only a burning sensation from the region of his kidneys prevented him from fainting dead away. He waved at Orin, motioning him to spread out. The Reaper couldn't hold Delvecchio in two directions at once. Orin, eyes fixed on the hypnotic yellow eyes of the pale black-clad figure before them, did not respond. Valentine stepped backwards, rifle at his shoulder. The thing turned its gaze to Valentine, bringing Orin out of his trance. Seeing Valentine stepping away, Orin turned and ran off into the night, discarding gun and pack.
Run! I'll catch you! Hide! I'll find you!
The Reaper again shifted its attention back to Valentine in a quick, lizard-like movement.
Shoot, and I'll pull your legs apart, one joint at a time, as easily as you'd yank off a fly's wings.
Valentine continued pacing backwards, lowering the gun barrel somewhat. He stepped behind a thick tree trunk, aiming his gun.
Useless!
The thing looked at Gil, the young man quivering in its grasp. It drew the thrashing figure close.
You got one thing right, foodling. I am a god.
The Reaper turned him around, pointed teeth tearing a hole in his neck and severing his windpipe.
Sorry, Gil. Hope you do the same for me.
The .45 shell found Delvecchio's backpack. The dynamite exploded in pinkish-orange light, throwing Valentine on his back with a warm, irresistible punch. Valentine's ears roared and his head filled with light as he plunged into unconsciousness. It was almost dinner time when the exhausted residents of Weening heard a shout from the guard tower. A moment's pause while the watchers in the tower employed an old telescopic sight. The residents gathered, the still smoldering barn behind them, to greet the strange apparition. Barefoot, pants in tatters, shirt reduced to a few ribbons, and pale with fatigue, David Valentine walked into Weening. He held his rifle in one hand and bulging backpack in the other. He examined the crowd, looking for a face.
Mr. Helm.
He reached into his backpack.
We killed the thing that got your son. And Gab. And Gil. Steve, I don't know about.
Valentine pulled out a skull covered in sticky soot from the fire he'd used to burn off the flesh and hair. In everything but color, it resembled a human skull, with an oversized forehead and an unusually long jawbone. The charred bone was bluish black and looked as if it had been carved from a block of onyx. Randall Helm refused the offering and instead put his arms around the weary 18-year-old and walked him home. That evening, Bourne opened a jug of homemade whiskey, and he, Valentine, and Helm took turns solemnly chiseling the names Gilman Delvecchio, Gabriella Cho, and Dorian Helm into the polished obsidian skull of the Reaper, still a little warm from its hours in the boiling pot. By the time the jug was recorked, the skull was mounted, slightly askew and off-center due to alcohol-impaired judgment, over the main gate of the village. It stands there still. Wachita Mountains, February of the 41st year of the Kurian Order. The snow is retreating up the rugged, rocky hills of the Wachitas, but an Arkansas winter still sits firmly in the saddle. In the narrow valley between two low mountain ranges, pointing like cleft fingers at the blasted ruins of Little Rock, a little collection of cabins mark the temporary home of Fort Candela. It is a fort in name only. The soldiers are scattered across 12 square miles of the valley floor. There is electricity most of the time, and fresh food some of the time, but warmth and companionship by the cabin hearths always. The erratic war is blessedly far from the men and women quartered in this valley. They concentrate on making and repairing equipment, cutting and sewing new uniforms, eating, drinking, gambling, and trading. And most important, training. This winter, like every other for the past 20-odd years, recruits get paired up with seasoned veterans until the green soldiers can do what the vets do and know what the vets know. Specialists and artisans travel through, giving lessons and once in a while taking on permanent apprentices if a recruit shows unusual ability at veterinary work, perhaps, or in making quality leather goods. The officers in charge of Fort Candela make decisions and act on them. One recruit has hopelessly bad vision, another drinks too much, and another cannot keep up on practice marches. The culls are offered support jobs, honorable service in paid labor outfits, or are returned to civilian life. Those who do not try for home are absorbed by the labor-hungry farms and towns of the Ozark Free Territory, but a few malcontents become bummers and inevitably a matter for the law. For the rest, the question becomes guards or hunters. 7 out of 10 often go to the guards, the military regiments that provide a defensive corps for the Ozark Free Territory. Guard service is rewarding. The soldiers get the finest uniforms Southern Command can produce, ample ammunition for marksmanship training, and frequent parties and barbecues, games, and riding contests. Many of them are mounted, adding to their dash and swagger. They also get plenty of opportunities to mix with civilians. No New Year's dance is complete without a handsome contingent of young guards in polished boots and crisp charcoal gray uniforms, kepis with regimental colored neckerchiefs hanging to precisely the base of their tunic collars. The guards are the well-ordered, well-disciplined, reassuring face of Southern Command, who can and do fight, giving their lives in defense of wives, children, and sweethearts. The others, the men and women who will become cold-eyed hunters ranging outside the friendly reaches of the Ozark Free Territory to slay the minions and quislings of the Kurians, are brought before the Life Weavers. A glossy black house cat named Sailor Tom ruled the cabin with an iron paw. 6 men shared the bunkhouse nestled in a hollow between 2 spurs of Fourchet Mountain, but none disputed the feline's claim to the warmest chair by the stone fireplace or the best tidbit from the steer quarter hung in the cool room. The heavy cat looked like a witch's familiar with a lynx somewhere in the family tree. He strutted around the cabin on muscular rear legs, half wild and all attitude. Sailor Tom asserted his authority with a rising corkscrew growl that blossomed into a biting, clawing fury aimed at anyone foolish enough to ignore that first and only warning. He gained his nickname when one wolf declared, "If that Tom spoke English, you'd just know he'd be cussing like a sailor." The men tolerated the bad-tempered cat and pointed him out to recruits as an example of tenacity to be imitated. The men depended on stored food to get them through the winter, and Sailor Tom exterminated trespassing mice, rats, squirrels, and even rabbits with samurai spirit. The cat's realm encompassed a two-room sooty kingdom full of beds and furniture as roughly finished as the men who occupied them. A fireplace of watercourse stones dominated one entire wall at the sitting part of the bunkhouse, and a 200-years-old and still-going-strong pot-bellied stove warmed the sleeping part, a musky warren of bunk beds and old blankets hung for gloomy privacy. Four veteran wolves and two recruits shared the cabin. Pankow, Gavino, Big Seth, and Imai saw to it that neither David Valentine nor Marquez, the other wolf aspirant, enjoyed a moment's peace. Anytime they were not actually in the field or attending a lesson as part of their caste training, the four senior wolves dedicated themselves to seeing that the would-be hunters idled as little as possible. Not just with training. Marquez found himself held responsible for the firewood supply and general cabin maintenance. The firewood might seem an easy task for a man in the middle of a forest, but the wolves insisted that Marquez fell and consequently hauled the timber from 2 miles away. If he so much as looked at one of the bushy pines surrounding the cabin, the trainers accused him of wanting to expose their temporary home to the enemy. The wolves assigned everything else to Valentine. Everything else included cooking, washing up, laundry, stocking the pantry, mending, disposing of Sailor Tom's half-eaten corpus rodentia, and the morning ersatz coffee. The men accepted a certain amount of slackness and inefficiency in all his responsibilities, excepting the last. No matter that Valentine may have returned from a night orientation march, exhausted at the first pink of dawn, if the coffee was not steaming and ready to be poured at the customary rising hour of 6 a.m., he was thoroughly cursed and punished. This required a fell run up Bald Knob, a 40-degree grade hill bare of trees, under the disapproving eyes of the four coffeeless wolves. Valentine learned from all four, but his principal mentor was Evan Pankow, the child of a representative from Ohio. The then 7-year-old congressman's son had watched his privileged world disappear in a few insane weeks when the raving madness virus swept the United States. Young Evan was one of the few people immune to the virus. While this protected him from a death that claimed better than 3/4 of the United States population, his genes were useless against the war and chaos that followed. He followed a stream of refugees into the tidewater of Virginia, where he got his first taste of the Kurian Order. He witnessed an albino man with yellowish eyes and a soft voice claiming to be a crisis governor kill an entire family in a hotel room. The boy, forever after avoiding the Reapers, was flown southwest by a woman who had also witnessed the crisis governor in action. Pankow had lost his parents, and she had lost a son, leading the two to form an increasingly real mother-son bond. The pilot's name was Jamie Costas, a former journalist who wrote some of the first pamphlets examining the Kurian Order. Her early writings, accurate in fact, but mistaken in analysis, brought her to the attention of the Life Weavers. Through her, Evan became a student of the Life Weavers and a wolf. In his 20s, Pankow helped found Southern Command. Now 50, with a seamed face and world-weary eyes that reminded Valentine of a portrait of Ernest Hemingway he had seen in one of the Padre's books, Pankow devoted himself to training a new generation of wolves to carry on the struggle. One late February afternoon, with snow camouflaging the mud surrounding the little cabin, Pankow lectured his aspirant about, of all things, tea.
It's way too easy when you're outdoors and on the move to just eat rabbits and such.
Pankow ran his ungloved hand across the soft needles of a mountain spruce.
Especially in cold weather. You get hungry for meat and fat and you forget about everything else. But you gotta get your greens. You know what vitamins are?
Yes, sir, I do.
It's those letters, A, B, and C, and so on.
Yeah, well, when I was a squirt, we got them in stuff like breakfast cereal, little candy pills. Damn near everything said vitamin fortified. Now, it's not so easy, it being winter. You take these spruce needles. In the spring, the little buds taste pretty good. You can just chew them. But if we pull some of these needles and boil them up into tea, you get as much vitamin C as from an orange, even. Have you ever had an orange?
Valentine shook his head.
Yeah, too bad. Sweet and juicy like a watermelon, but tart, too. Anyway, your greens aren't a problem in summer. Any fool can pull up a dandelion, chew its leaves, and roast the root. But winter, that's a different story. You don't get your vitamins. You end up losing teeth, getting fevers. You'll catch some virus and die even if the scurvy doesn't take you. Trappers in Canada used to die of it. Rabbit fever, it was called. They were starving their bodies to death while stuffing themselves with fresh meat every night. So never just eat meat on the trail or at home. Add a lot of greens if you value your eyesight and your teeth.
We should just raid more food off the Koreans.
That's not so easy. But before you can fight, you have to be healthy in mind and body. I know it seems hard what we've been having you do, but soon your body's gonna be like a whole new machine. We're trying to get you as strong as possible so nothing quits on you once you start keeping the way of the wolf.
When will that be?
Well, that's not for me to say. Not for you to say, not for the captain to say. It's up to the old wizard. He might be watching you now. He might be advising the governor in Mountain Home. One thing is for sure. No one who meets him comes away the same as he was before.
Back at the cabin, like a demon invoked by mention of his name, word from the Life Weaver waited in the form of a small printed list. The cabin was empty, save for Seth and Sailor Tom, both napping in front of the Franklin stove.
Amu's called an invocation.
Big Seth spoke from his modified bunk. Reinforced wooden wings accommodated his 6-foot-6-inch frame and supported an elongated mattress of his own making.
Starting Saturday, running for a week. 115 fresh wolves in this bash, thank God.
Nice to see the roster growing this year. Many's a summer we had less than the year before.
Pankow reached for the typed sheet of paper.
Let's see the list. Oh, Marquez made it. Bad news, Valentine.
He watched Valentine's face fall.
You made it, Valentine. In fact, you're last on the list.
Valentine felt ambivalent at Pankow's joke, but a little pride still crept into his voice.
At least I made it, even if I'm dead last.
Now, don't take it that way, son. It ain't a good or bad thing being last, just means they may want to take more time.
Doing what? Tattoos? A Vulcan mind meld? What?
Hell, Valentine, where did you come up with that? A little before your time, and they haven't done reruns in over 40 years.
My dad liked to read science fiction. The man who brought me up after he died taught me to read my dad's books. But what is this transformation you all keep hitting about?
Big Seth and Pankow exchanged a look. Pankow shook Valentine's hand.
You'll just have to meet Father Wolf and see for yourself. Magic, son, is a little hard to explain.
The week dragged on, and Valentine made it pass more quickly by devouring the few books in the cabin. A heavy snowstorm came, and the wolves relaxed the tough schedule shared by the two aspirants. Valentine gratefully retreated to his bunk. Pankow gave him a pamphlet written by his foster mother. Printed in heavy, slightly smeared type, and cumbersomely titled Fallen Gods, The History, Theory, and Practice of the Kurian Order, it was 50 pages relating the history of the Life Weavers, their schism over the use of vital auras to attain immortality, and the Kurian takeover of Earth.
The Kurians failed in their first effort to take Earth because it was chaotic, badly planned, and they had not even consolidated their victory on Kor itself, where knots of Lifeweaver resistance slowed them. Humanity owes these brave souls a 4,000-year debt of gratitude. Mankind, in its primitive, isolated state, was less vulnerable to the spread of the rabies plague and quicker to accept the word and help of the Life Weavers. We hunted the horrors that came over from Kerr, closed the doors, and having eradicated the threat, promptly forgot about it 200 years before Stonehenge was built. Vampires became rumor, then legend, and the cast of the bear trickled down into human legend as the berserkers of the Norse sagas. Certainly a Kurian or two remained on Earth, lurking in untraveled corners of the globe, and Kurian-designed spawn, now known generically as Grogs and individually through slang and names out of mythology, no doubt survived to trouble humanity now and again as it pushed back the borders of the unknown. But though the gates of the Interworld Tree were closed, the Kurians in their red-clouded underground world learned in the long years of their exile how to open new ones. When and where the first of the new portals were opened is a matter of some dispute. Even the Life Weavers are unable to say. It could have been as early as the Dark Ages in the Balkans, or as late as the 18th century. Opening the portals requires enormous sacrifices of vital auras to achieve. But after the first Kurr came through the new gate or gates, humanity aided the Kurians in this all too frequently. Humanity took the first step toward its own overthrow. Over the years, the Kurians recruited human allies, perhaps by striking Faustian bargains. The Kurian moles gained positions of trust and authority in society. With the new millennium, the dragon's teeth sown in the last 100 or so years of man's history were ready to grow. In the first week of June 2022, they sprang the trapdoor on the vital auras of Earth's 7 billion inhabitants.
The door to the cool room opened noisily, and Gavino entered the cabin. He walked over to the hearth, apparently not seeing Valentine, and took the jug of Busthead down from its place on the shelf. Gavino collapsed in the leather-webbed camp chair by the empty fireplace, took a long pull, and stared at the cold ashes. Sailor Tom took advantage of the warm lap, and Gavino scratched the cat between the ears without looking at it. Valentine considered greeting him, but didn't wish to be given something to do. He returned to his booklet.
The Overthrow. The world was already a miserable place in the spring of that cursed year. The new depression was at its height. Stocks fell, jobs were lost, and consumer consumption fell in a corporate death spiral as the aging technozars were revealed to have feet of clay. Financial institutions underreacted, the government overreacted, and a society living on borrowed time, paid for with borrowed dollars, failed. Hard times and hunger came to the Western world, which was all the more of a shock because the generation that survived the last financial collapse had virtually died out. Ancient hatred smoldered and burst into flame. Europe saw its first real war in generations over food tariffs. China used America's preoccupation with its economy to overrun Taiwan. Russia and Japan, both backing different factions in Europe and the Pacific Rim, started a naval war that the United States, in its last great overseas commitment, stopped by cordoning off the two powers. Civil unrest over the use of American wealth and resources abroad, with so many suffering at home, erupted into violence. Paramilitary groups took a hodgepodge of economic, political, and even racial grievances to the ultimate court of violence. A few polarizing and charismatic leaders further unraveled the tattered American social fabric. The Earth itself added its cataclysmic voice to the dissonant chorus of human suffering. A worldwide string of earthquakes and volcanic eruptions leveled cities and made ash-covered wastelands of regions near the volcanoes. Particles in the atmosphere changed the climate more to the Kurians' liking. As if the tectonic damage was not enough, a plague added to the chaos. People called it rabies, but its 24 to 72-hour incubation cycle and mind-altering effects made the cure seem more like a job for exorcists than doctors. Wild mobs tore through the cities in a biting and clawing frenzy that shattered civic order. It was not even suspected at the time that both events were long planned. Kurian technology allowed the fallen Life Weavers to use the Earth itself as a weapon and the disease, which we know today as raving madness, had appeared on Earth in the first Kurian invasion. The pale, robed reapers began to walk the night. The reapers strode into the maelstrom, alternately cowing and killing. They commanded legions of grogs, genetically altered creatures designed to break up opposition. As fearless in battle as army ants, the most common form is a large rhino-hided ape with hands and brains capable of using weaponry from assault rifles to armored personnel carriers. The military and civil forces of the United States, already unable to deal with the plague and widespread destruction, succumbed as spare parts, ammunition, and especially morale ran out. A few Kurian agents and collaborators in the command structure helped orchestrate defeat on a grand scale. In the final extreme, a scorched earth policy destroyed military bases and their equipment to keep them out of the hands of the Kurians. A few nuclear and chemical weapons were used in the last gasp of the war. But this added to the suffering rather than slowing the Kurian takeover. The end came with a bang and a whimper. The president shot himself when he learned his family had caught the raving madness virus at a riot in Quantico. And the vice president fled with a few leading members of Congress to Mount Omega after she read the president's final executive order. In it, the despairing president declared, like the captain of a sinking ship, that the situation was, quote, every man for himself. The United States, and as far as we can tell the rest of the world, belonged to the Kurians within a year.
Valentine could understand why Kostos ended her life as a hard-drinking woman. The facts of life of the New World Order came more easily to Valentine, who had been born well after the Kurian takeover. No memories of the vanished security and assorted technological delights of the past haunted him, just a wistful curiosity. He sometimes felt a schism between himself and Pankow's generation, including even the Padre. They cherished and fought for the past, a flag with stars and stripes, a way of living that would probably never return. Valentine wanted to win back his future. Valentine glanced up from the old red pamphlet and looked at Gavino. The wolf set the jug on the floor and shuffled over to his bed, a sad and sick look visiting his face with every intention of staying the night.
You okay, Don?
Hey, Val. Didn't see you there. Pankow giving you some slack?
He rode up the Happy Trail today.
The Happy Trail getaway was a saloon where the bartender was friendly to the wolves, and the girls were even friendlier, if the words were kind and the price was right. The price being anything from a new pair of shoes to an old song, depending on the charm of the man.
I think he's letting up on me with the invocation a day away. All I had to do was draw him a hot bath and put an edge on the razor. He told me I couldn't eat anything and just take it easy. Wouldn't tell me why I couldn't eat, though.
Valentine, Marquez is dead. Can't think of any other way to say it.
The aspirant's thoughts about-faced and came to attention in a hurry.
What?
Gavino sat on his bed, a bunk away from Valentine's. A sheet of laundry hung between them.
It just happens sometimes, boy. He made it through the invocation fine. It's not like you run an Indian gauntlet or something. He got out of the cave and just lost it. It can affect you funny. I remember I got out of mine and all I could smell was wood smoke on everything. He looked around like he didn't know where he was and took off at a run. Jumped right off the damn cliff. I remember 2 years ago, one kid quit eating after it. Wouldn't touch any food, always saying it was diseased or filthy or something. He starved himself to death, just threw up when we force-fed him. Usually the guys who come over funny are just jumpy for a couple of days, and then they come around. Bad business with Marquez. A couple others volunteered to go down and get the body. I only saw it from 300 feet up.
My God, what made...
Hey, David, don't let it get to you. He just wasn't wired right, and sometimes not even the wizard can spot that. You'll be fine.
Ugh.
Gavino's drunken prediction was something Valentine reminded himself of again as he climbed the mountainside with 10 other aspirants, the last set supposed to meet with the Life Weaver, known variously as Amu, the Wizard, and Father Wolf. Named Winter Home Mountain, the 2,200-foot cap of rock and snow looked like a shark's tooth from some angles and a sagging teepee from others. The cave was a little more than halfway up, set back from Marquez's fatal cliff by a sloping meadow. Five goats grazed there, some stripping bark from the stunted mountain pine and others pawing at the lingering snow to expose dead bracken underneath. Two totem poles flanked the crescent-shaped entrance to the cave. Carved wolf heads, ears erect and eyes alert, crowned the poles. Carved names covered the rest of the pole, some with dates written afterwards. Valentine decided these must be the toll poles, mobile gravestones for wolves who died in battle. Not so bad, Valentine thought. A few hundred names for 20 years of fighting. Just inside the cave, 11 more poles, filled with tightly packed names, formed an arch the recruits filed under like a wedding party passing under crossed swords. Valentine paused and ran a finger over the carved names on one of the poles. Would his name join the long list? The tunnel widened into a teardrop-shaped cave with a curtain at one end. What might have been a tapestry decorated the curtain. Valentine couldn't make out much in the dim light trickling in from the entrance, even after his eyes adjusted. The two wolves guiding them motioned for them to sit.
Just keep quiet and let him work you one at a time. After the ceremony, they'll be kind of twitchy, so keep still and quiet when they come out.
The curtain moved as a wet black nose appeared. A canine head the size of a champion pumpkin lifted the curtain, revealing blazing blue eyes that reminded Valentine of a husky from the Boundary Waters. A wolf that could be mistaken for a pony by its size strode into the ring of aspirants sitting around the edges of the cave. It had striking white fur, with black tips visible only up close. It sniffed each man, stepping sideways on paws the size of horseshoes.
Thank you all for earning your places in this cave.
A rich, cultivated voice came from the wolf's mouth, which did not seem to be forming any words. The wolf quivered and blurred, to be replaced by a smiling old man.
Forgive the dramatic entrance. It's an illusion that impressed your ancestors. I continue it out of love of tradition. I hope you all know who I am.
Amu, said some of those present. The wizard, said a few others. Valentine just nodded. There was something noble and strong about the man, Valentine thought, but with just a hint of tired lunacy in his frosty blue eyes. Valentine, for some reason, thought of Cervantes' Don Quixote.
My name is not as important as who I am, a matter entirely different from a simple name. For I am going to be your father. You all have a biological father who started your life, and most of you believe in a spiritual father who will take you unto him after death. I am here to be a third father. I will give you rebirth.
11 separate faces digested this.
Yes, I am speaking in riddles. Riddles are simple, usually after you hear the answer. But I am a busy man and would prefer to deal with each of you individually.
The wizard was standing in front of a husky, curly-haired youth.
Michael Jeremy Wallers, I'll see you first.
What?
The prospective wolf shot to his feet, narrowly missing crashing his head against the ceiling.
How did—
I didn't.
The wizard opened the curtain and gracefully pointed with his chin to the inner cavity.
You did.
Valentine spent 4 increasingly sore hours waiting his turn. Hungry, anxious, cold, and confused seemed a strange way to go through this invocation ceremony. He watched each of the 10 other recruits emerge one at a time from behind the tapestry and stare about at those remaining as if they had never seen them before. Pete, the Viking giant who came down from northern Minnesota with Valentine, looked around at the remaining aspirants suspiciously, as if 15 minutes ago he had not been shifting from one aching buttock to the other with the rest of them.
Pete, how'd it go?
The blonde jumped away from Valentine like a horse startled by a firecracker. His head connected with the cavern roof, and he crashed to the ground, unconscious.
Told you to keep quiet! If he ain't up by the time you're done, you're carrying him out.
Pete rolled onto all fours. Pete staggered to his feet and lurched out of the cave, rubbing the back of his head.
Oh, that's just fine. Now the other three are sure to puke.
And puke they did. As the last two returned to the cave, they each added their own puddle of bile to the floor of the cave before fleeing to the open air outside. Valentine wondered if this was the reason for the orders not to eat anything.
You're up, kid. Through the looking glass you go, Alice.
Valentine pulled the tapestry aside and stepped through.
Glad this happens only twice a year.
The tunnel wound downward, illuminated by nearly guttered candles set into the irregular sides of the cave. Valentine counted 20 paces before a second heavy piece of cloth blocked his progress. He didn't know whether to just open it, say his name, or tap on the material. He cleared his throat.
Come in. Come in, Valentine the Younger.
He entered, bending beneath the low rock arch. The cave was warm and well lit, with a clean, inviting smell, which Valentine identified as balsam. The warmth and light came from an apple-sized glowing ball that floated a few inches below the cave's 8-foot ceiling. It was bright, but somehow did not pain Valentine's eyes, even when he looked directly at it. The room reminded Valentine of the inside of an igloo, were the igloo constructed out of grayish ice. Father Wolf sat cross-legged in the center of the room on a woven rug. The floor of the cave was a mass of pine needles and small branches, with more patterned rugs thrown over the boughs. 5 four-legged wolves snored in a companionable heap near the door.
My bodyguard, you might say. Long ago, in another part of your world, I traveled with 20 of them. It made more of an impression on those simple folk. They lived in fear of wolves. I've grown rather fond of them, and should our enemies discover me here, I would remask myself and slip out with them. Sit down, please.
Valentine sat, grateful for the cushioning needles and rug after the hard floor of the outer cave.
What do you want me to do?
The question would be better put as, what do you want to do? Why did you leave Minnesota? You did not come south just for a change of geography.
I want to do my part.
The wizard smiled at this.
Simply put, I hear something a little different from each young man or woman. They want to defend hearth and home, liberate their enslaved fellow men, and kick the invaders back into their kennels. What is needed from you, and what you can give me, if you are true to yourself, is an outlet for your hatred. Hatred makes for good killers. The word is anathema. Your religions rightly discourage it, because it makes poor mortar for a society. But, young Valentine, your race is being eaten. You should be consumed by hate. Your every breath should be drawn to curse your enemies. It gives you energy and a purpose and a determination that only love matches. The more you love your fellow men, the more you should be aflame with hatred for your foe. Your culture is so full of the image of the reluctant warrior that it is an archetype. The man who kills regretfully, who goes into battle terrified but gets the job done and then shows mercy to his enemy afterwards. That kind of man will keep the free territory upright for a while, but he will not win the war, not against this enemy. There is a beast in you that I'm going to help you release. If you agree, that is. I give fair warning, though. It means a vicious life and perhaps a hard end. You will live only to kill our enemies until you yourself are slain. Few of my warriors retire to marry, as your father did. So if you want a role inside the human family, I'm giving you a chance to walk out of this cave and down the hill with your humanity intact. You can serve with honor in the guards, living up to the image of noble crusader, or go back into hiding. There are many ways to do the right thing. Stay with us, though, and you will become the thing the enemy fears in the night. The prey will become the predator.
Valentine wondered how many refused the offer. How many men wanted to be killers? He had expected physical or mental tests, not a moral one. Valentine thought of his father, but could not make the connection between the wizard's animalistic killers and the quiet man who was shot to death in his own backyard.
Why don't the Life Weavers fight? I would think that with your technology, magic I've heard it called, you'd be able to beat the Kurians.
The wizard seemed a little surprised.
Usually I ask the questions, but I will do my best to answer yours. We are not any good at it. It would be like you defecating in your pants. You could do it if you put your mind to it, but you would not enjoy the experience. And until you had a chance to clean yourself, you would probably be preoccupied. We toilet trained ourselves far too long ago. We are not numerous, and my ability to change into a wolf does not mean I could bite like one. You Homo sapiens, on the other hand, are almost perfect killing machines. You are flexible, aggressive, intelligent, and inventive. We examined life forms on 12 worlds, and you, half-savages, revert to your terrible earlier selves with greater alacrity than any other. So we help you fight your battles. And in doing so, you fight our war for us. Or am I speaking in riddles again?
No, I understand. It's your method I question. Instead of arming us with some kind of advanced technology, you turn us feral. That seems a strange way to help us win a war.
Valentine was startled when the wizard abruptly disappeared, only to emerge from the dome-shaped cave's other exit, carrying what looked like a small mirror on a stand.
I am sorry. I had to get this, and I didn't want to interrupt, so I left you talking to an image. You said you understood, David. It is clear that you do not. I'm giving you the most powerful weapon on the planet, yourself, at your full potential.
I thought I was supposed to make up my mind.
You did, David. You did.
Amu again sat down opposite the young man.
The moment you thought of your father and his death and wondered if he was the kind of man I want you to become, you may not have felt it, but to me your fury was white hot. You can hide your rage from yourself, but not from me. It is so big, I wonder where you put it so you can sleep at night.
The item the wizard placed between them looked like a plate-sized round mirror. It hovered at face level between them, held up by the same mysterious force that kept the light globe near the ceiling. Valentine saw in it only his own reflection, but fuzzy and out of focus, conforming to his general outline.
What is this?
A Amu's face appeared in the mirror. The Life Weaver's visage melted and shifted as though his skin were made of clouds boiling in the wind.
You could say it's the surgeon's scalpel, David. I will use it to operate on you. There is a cup in front of you. Drink up.
Valentine looked down at the woven rug. A wooden cup, round like a hollowed-out coconut, sat before him. Had it been sitting there all the time? Valentine sniffed at it suspiciously.
Just a little something to facilitate the ceremony. It is tasteless.
Valentine drank. Just before consciousness faded, he looked into the mirror thing. First he saw his face, then the wizard's, then a wolf's. The images flickered together. Wizard, wolf, self, wizard, wolf, self, wizard, wolf, self. But they were not his, not Amu's. The wolf's. Valentine found himself fixing on the eyes of the three faces as they morphed from one manifestation to the next, all sharing the same ice-blue stare. The young wolf awoke to an overwhelming farrago of sounds and smells. The pine needles, musty rugs, dried lichens on the walls, and living wolves all vied to overthrow his brain. He could hear their heartbeats as with a stethoscope. Their breathing sounded like a gale. Too much, his brain shrieked at him. Valentine leaped up and hurled himself away from the sleeping pack as if flung by a catapult, bruising himself with the force of the impact against the wall.
David, stay calm. Your senses are just sharpened up a little, that's all. I will help you through your first days. Then you will learn on your own. You must learn to switch your senses between two levels, hard and soft. You have to learn how to hear with soft ears and smell with soft nose first. You will use the hard ears and hard nose later to sense over distance.
Where are you?
Valentine could hear the echo of his voice in the outer cavern where he had waited before being called.
I have linked us. I cannot understand you very well. I am not as gifted as some in this type of communication with human thought shapes. I just get impressions about your emotions. You need to take a deep breath. Fill your lungs with air and relax. Draw everything back into your center. Soften your eyes. Let them go out of focus. Soften your ears. Let them relax and listen to the sound of the empty air in front of you. Soften your nose and smell the heat of the light cube.
Valentine tried to relax, but the smell and sound of the slumbering wolves kept beating down the barriers. He felt dazed.
You are doing very well. I think you are a natural. Try to walk out of the cave the way you came in.
The musty old tapestry at the door reeked abominably, and Valentine hurried past it. His legs were suddenly working too fast, and he crashed into the cavern wall, like a mechanized toy bouncing off an obstacle in its path. He steadied himself, but the flickering candles sounded like whip cracks in his ears.
Center! Center! No, you still don't have it. Let me help you.
Valentine felt himself steady, the cacophony of sensations fading into the background. He made it to the other curtain, but as he pushed through it, the acidic vomit smell overthrew him.
Serves you right.
Valentine leaped forward in alarm, but could not keep control of his spastic body and missed the exit. He ricocheted off the unforgiving stone and came away bleeding at the forehead. The coppery-smelling fluid infiltrated his nostrils, took over his sense of smell.
Breathe. Breathe. Bring it back to your center. Try crawling outside. You're fine.
The young wolf did not feel fine.
Hell, I think Father Wolf turned him all the way up.
He heard the man's whisper behind cupped palm. On hands and knees, Valentine crawled through the cave, toward the light outside. He could smell the blood trail behind.
The wizard thought that Marquez was something special, too. Sent him right off the cliff.
Valentine, remembering what had happened yesterday, brought himself back down with a determined effort. The world seemed almost normal. He climbed to his feet.
Good, good. Outdoors can be a little much. Just keep breathing into your center and drawing everything back to that place inside you. You will learn in time. A good bloodhound controls his nose without even realizing it. The way you focus your eyes, you will be able to do the same soon.
Valentine made it into the daylight. Clear blue filled the sky overhead, a rarity on Kurian Earth. The snow seemed to gleam. And even across the valley, Valentine's visual acuity was such that he literally could not see the forest for the individual trees. It smelled as if he were standing in the center of the world's largest goat farm, despite the fact that the three goats stood 100 yards away, downwind. He centered on his own body.
David, try to find some goat droppings.
The voice in his head still made him uncomfortable. Although his nose told him he was in a sea of goat shit. Valentine localized it with an effort and walked toward the still warm source, pausing less and less frequently as he drew nearer. He found he could play with his ears as easily as his eyes. He located a creaking branch and listened to one of the goats pull up fodder from beneath the snow.
There you are.
Valentine stood over the rounded mass, the end of his pungent treasure hunt.
Now, David, you are doing excellently. Follow the trail the goats left.
Not by using the tracks in the snow, but with your nose. Shut your eyes as much as possible. Hear and smell your way down the mountainside.
It occurred to him that none of the other wolves had explored the field in this way. Valentine would have known, since most of them had left within the last few hours, and there were only a few irregular, staggering footprints in the field. He took a deep breath, closed his eyes, and began to smell for the trail left by the odoriferous goats. And fell flat on his face. A tree root hidden in the snow snagged his foot. Usually, Valentine was agile enough to catch himself if tripped, but his usual reflexes had gone AWOL. He had the disquieting sensation of being in a different body. The only memory he could compare it to was his rare all-day fishing expeditions in Minnesota, taking a small boat into a lake and then feeling a little unsteady on his feet when he returned to dry land. He got up, closed his eyes again with an effort, and began walking with an unsteady tread like a drunk doing a Frankenstein's monster imitation. Valentine found he could hear the location of trees by the sound of wind in the pine needles. He sensed a branch ahead and leaned back to avoid it. And fell flat on his back. The goats showed a penchant for investigating clumps of thorny bramble.
Ah, damn it!
After a painful rake across his lips, Valentine opened his eyes.
No peeking.
Valentine sucked the blood from his punctured lip, took a deep breath, and tried again. He leaned forward and found the going easier with his hands placed ahead and his nose closer to the trail. Even when he bashed his head straight into a tree trunk, coming away with sticky pine bark tangled in his hair, he managed to keep his eyes closed. He found himself able to concentrate on the trail, letting the other senses fade into the background, like a reader absorbed in a book, using just her eyes and her brain. The odor became stronger, and Valentine let out a yip like a foxhound. He began to lope, ignoring the bruises and scrapes as he bounced down the slope. He heard a panicked bleat from something ripe and warm. And he leaped. The goat collapsed under him, kicking. The animal's struggles brought him out of his trance. He found himself with a mouthful of goat hair, feeling as if he had just woken from a vivid dream. He released the unfortunate herbivore.
Sorry, Billy. I got carried away.
Terrible!
The wizard shouted into his brain.
Had you been following someone with a gun, they would have shot you like a frothing dog. You mustn't go feral. Do it again. But this time, see if you can find one of your fellow wolves as they disperse. Just follow him. Don't let him see you. Open your eyes now and then if you must. But try to work with your former semi-dormant senses as much as possible. Practice. Because when it's for real, there are no second chances.
David Valentine, Wolf of the Southern Command, got his new, awkward, battered body to its feet, closed his eyes, and stalked on.